from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Say the name Jesus, and you've got 2,000 years of history, passion, belief, and conflict before you in an instant. Centuries of faith, centuries of questioning the historical Jesus, the divine Jesus, Son of Man, Son of God, teacher, seer. Novelist, poet, and biographer Jay Parini turns back to this extraordinary figure in a new book of history and meditation. This hour On Point, still thinking about Jesus. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What is Jesus to you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Middlebury, Vermont is Jay Parini, poet, novelist, biographer, professor of English and creative writing at Middlebury College. His previous books include The Passage of H.M. and The Last Station about Leon Tolstoy and many, many more. His new book is titled Jesus, The Human Face of God. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Jay Parini, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. It's nice to be on the show again. Thanks.
It's so nice to have you here.
Yeah.
Lots of questions. I guess, first of all, where are you coming from? Are you writing this as a scholar, a believer, an artist? I mean, you're a poet after all. What?
Let's just say a little of everything. I've been thinking about this stuff for 50 years. My father was a Baptist minister, and I grew up every morning he would read the King James to me, and from age of 5 to the age of 18. So when I went off to college, I had, you know, the key passages in the Bible in my head. And I've been interested for an interested seeker. I've been an Episcopal, a member of the Episcopal Church here in Vermont for, you know, 30-some years. So I come as a believer, but of a certain kind of, there are thousands of kinds of believers. I come as a believer in the sense the word believe means in, you know, Middle English to hold something dearly. And this is a story I hold very dearly. And I think it's a story that has transforming powers.
As you say, many kinds of belief. There's one. We'll look at that aspect and your whole big focus on the connections between Jesus and philosophical teachings from the East. But you early on, you ask, who was this man, Jesus of Nazareth? You say, you know, was he a wandering rabbi, a magician, a healer, an exorcist, an apocalyptic visionary? Mm. How do you answer that question?
Well, I think I try to lay before the reader in this book all the different possibilities. But I'm saying over and again that this is one of the great stories of all time. So much of the trend in modern 20th century theology has been to demythologize Jesus. Mm-hmm. What I say in my first chapter is I'm trying to re-mythologize Jesus. I'm trying to get back to the basic story and understand how it unfolds in real time and then in cosmic time. You know, myth is such a great word. It doesn't mean a story that's not true. It means a story that's especially true. I always say that myth is a kind of tear in the fabric of reality through which all this amazing spiritual energy pours. And I'm trying to, you know, trace the outline of that mythos.
So take us into the story then. And what about it? I mean, there's a man and a whole lot of others behind it. But what about it? Do you think, after all of your meditation and research here, has made it so big for so long?
I think that Jesus is the paradigmatic man or human being. I think he shows us in this image, again, going back to the story, and I'm interested in both its literal level but especially its metaphorical level. This story tells us, okay, life is a very uncomfortable place. There's a lot of violence. There's a lot of sadness. There's so much suffering everywhere we look. We see the poor are with us. There's wars and rumors of wars. And I think Jesus had a special message to his disciples and then the people who gathered around him and then billions of people over 20 centuries. And it's a very simple message. It's a message of love. Love your neighbor as yourself. If somebody strikes you, turn the other cheek. In fact, I love in the Sermon on the Mount when he says, I'll go even further than turn the other cheek. If you should actually love your enemies. No, he says, I'll even go further. Do good to those that hate you. I mean, this is an extremely radical message and a powerful one. We see it, you know, it exhibited in this new pope. I've been following his story. You know, it's amazing to me to see that this brand new pope has really modeled the message of Jesus so beautifully with all these gestures he's taken on. really focusing on the poor, really focusing on those who are disenfranchised. He seems to have really read that great line in the Sermon on the Mount, "Judge not, lest ye be judged." When he was asked about gay people, he said, "You know, who am I to judge?" This is a pope who does not judge people, and he took his name, St. Francis, after the great Francis of Assisi, who through the Middle Ages was called Alter Christus, the second Christ. And I think that's because Francis so beautifully in the Middle Ages modeled this life of Christ. And it's a life of action in the world, how to behave in the world, how to talk to other people, how to negotiate your way through life, and how to love one another. I mean, Jesus really only left the one commandment, love one another as I have loved you. There are really only two things you have to do to be a Christian, love one another and love God. I mean, these are the two great injunctions. And so that's where I come down.
So trace this story, this teaching, back to its origins for us. I mean, you remind us that, you know, here was this Jewish guy living in a kind of distant corner of the Roman Empire, but it was a time of great tumult and ferment that also opened the way for philosophy and teaching. Where did this come from?
Well, think of it. Jesus is born in Nazareth, which is right on the Silk Road. And the Silk Road was this amazing commercial trace or track between west and east, east and west. And so Jesus is ideally situated. He's a kind of, I think of him as a kind of religious genius who's able to synthesize all these great ideas flowing in from the west, from Greece, ideas from Plato, ideas about body and soul. From the east, he's pulling in from China, from India, from Persia, ideas about karma. Blessed are the merciful, for God shall show mercy to them. Mm. And that's an ideal phrasing of the idea of karma. So Jesus is able to somehow synthesize all world religious truth in this single teaching, great body of teaching. It's all there in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, those great three chapters where pretty much everything you need to know about Christian ethics is right there.
I mean, we think of the Silk Road as Central Asia, not so much the Levant and ancient Israel. But you make a lot of this. I mean, how do you know that he was sitting in Nazareth getting word of karma over the Silk Road? Is there enough history on the flow of people and trade at that time to put reality on those bones?
You know, in the last 20, 30 years, there's been a tremendous amount of research into what's called Second Temple Judaism. Immense amount of work by Geza Vermes from Oxford, for example. So many scholars. I have a library of a shelf full of books on Second Temple Judaism. And this is that magical period. The first temple, remember, was Solomon's temple that was destroyed in 587. The Babylonians tore it down. And then it was gradually rebuilt, finally made into a splendid monument by King Herod, and then torn down in 70 AD. And so in this magical moment, right when Jesus is born, right as King Herod's reign is coming to an end, there were all kinds of circulating currents of thought. For instance, we now have the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they give us a real window into what was going on in Palestine at the time of Jesus. Ideas about the resurrection of the body, ideas about loving your neighbor as yourself. We have just a tremendous amount of knowledge that's come into view only in the last few years.
So was Jesus representative of that, or was he an outlier? I mean, you tell us there weren't even rabbis yet, the priests in Jerusalem, around the temple that were divided, that there were all these debates going on about the nature and worship of God and the proper form for religious practice. So was he an outlier, or was he representative of some, I don't know.
No, Jesus was not just an outlier. Jesus was a religious revolutionary. I think he was saying, look, we're going to overturn the way that rulers of the temples view religion. The Sadducees were an elite sect in Judaism who kind of had control of the temples. And they were asking people for a lot of money. That's why Jesus turned over the tables of the money changers in the forecourt of the great temple of Jerusalem, because he was angry that people were, you know, selling animals for sacrifice. He was putting an end to that sort of thing. So, you know, Jesus was crucified in part because he was such a revolutionary thinker, not a political revolutionary, but a revolutionary thinker who was bringing, he thought of himself, I think, as the new Moses. And so the writers of the four Gospels,
pretty big.
Pretty big. You know, look, he goes up on a mountain and delivers the Sermon on the Mount, just as Moses went up on Mount Sinai and delivered received the Ten Commandments from God. The parallels are there. You look at the Christmas story. So many figures in the Old Testament are announced by an angel coming to the mother saying, you're going to give birth to a miraculous child. This is the case with, you know, Abraham and Isaac and so forth and Sarah. And so the Christmas story, for example, here we are at this time of year's Christmas. Let's think about this. Think of the four Gospels for a moment. You've got Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. These stories are written, 40, 50, 60, John probably 100 years after Jesus lived. And they're speaking to very specialized communities. And so we get the Christmas story. I think it's a late addition to the Gospels, coming in only in Matthew and Luke. Mark seems to know nothing about the Christmas story. John makes no mention of it. In all of the letters of St. Paul, 13 letters, there's not one mention of Christmas, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, the manger in Bethlehem. This is a late addition to the gospel narrative. And these are two very different stories. Now, they're still very beautiful and have a lot of truth in them. But Matthew is written to the Jewish community, and he's trying to stress the royal heritage of Jesus. Luke is a more peasant kind of Jesus.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the still unfolding story of Jesus with novelist, poet, biographer, believer Jay Parini. He's out with the new book, Jesus, the Human Face of God. You pick up a couple of words and spend some time with them. One is repentance. I mean, love's a big word in this faith. Mm-hmm. Repentance and salvation are two more, but you give them a different treatment than is commonly shared. Take us there, Jay.
Well, Tom, one thing I did to write this book was to go back to the Greek New Testament, which I had studied in graduate school, and I've continued to read and read in a parallel. I use an interlinear translation where I can look at the Greek language and look at the English below it, and you know, I've studied certain key words, such as when the essence of Jesus' teaching, at least at one point, is in the King James Version. Or the Tyndale translation, which is the first English translation of the Bible, we read in Mark and in Matthew, repent and you will be saved. And so a lot has been made of those words. But the word repent is, in my view, a terrible mistranslation, a misrepresentation of the word metanoia, which means meta as in metaphor, to go beyond something. Noia means mind. And so, and salvation is the word soteria, which means a sense of well-being or enlightenment, is to my mind an even better translation of soteria. So think of how Christianity would be differently viewed right now and practiced if people in preaching in the pulpit said, Jesus tells you, open your mind to the larger mind of God, and you will experience enlightenment.
As opposed to repent and you will be saved.
Yeah, I think that's a very narrow version. I mean, it certainly is a possible translation, but it closes down rather than opens up the possibilities for the text. And the character of Jesus in the four Gospels uses this phrase, open your mind to the light or to the larger mind of God, 22 times. So it's an incredibly important part of his teaching.
What does it mean? It sounds like a broad gestural piece of advice, but what does it mean in its substance?
I think in substance it does mean a change of heart. I think Jesus is saying to us, open your heart and your mind, center yourself, come into touch with the Creator, and experience this kind of enlightenment, which will then enable you to go out in the world and to put into practice the kind of way of life I've been teaching you, to love your neighbors, not to judge people, to behave. If somebody slaps you, to turn your cheek and say, you're asking for my shirt, I'll give you my coat as well. It's an actual way of being in the world. And, you know, it's a very interesting, Jesus' whole life, his way of dealing with the poor, his actions, his integrity, his simple daily acts of generosity, and, you know, finally his complete self-giving on the cross is precious, and it reveals the mystery of the divine life in ways that I think are quite remarkable.
You call him a revolutionary, but you also write, you say it's important to keep in mind that Jesus was always a good, if unconventional, Jew.
Yeah, I think it, I mean, there's this great scholar I mentioned earlier, Geza Vermes from Oxford, and there are some contemporary scholars of Second Temple Judaism, such as a guy at Berkeley called Daniel Boyerin, and they've written astonishing studies of the Gospels as Judaic texts. And one thing I say is that Jesus was never trying to found a new religion. He was trying to, yes, in a sense, he was bringing a new covenant, so you could possibly call that a new religion, but essentially he was trying to modify and extend Judaism. There were things about the practice of Judaism in his day that he thought were inadequate, and he brings a new vision of how to be in the world and how to act toward the poor, toward the homeless, toward women taken in adultery. Almost my favorite story in the Bible is when Jesus is standing there with his disciples and some Pharisees come and say, look at this woman. She was just found committing adultery. It says in the Bible, in Leviticus, that we should stone somebody who's committed adultery. And Jesus says, let the one of you who's without sin cast the first stone. And one by one, the Pharisees peel away embarrassed. Then, of course, Jesus turns to the woman and he says, go your way now and sin no more. I mean, it's a powerful story, and the Gospels are full of example after example of how to behave toward other people in the world, especially those on the margins of society, those who are poor, those who are in material need and in spiritual need. Jesus is a healer in the greatest, largest sense here.
But not a judger in that story. It's interesting Pope Francis has picked up on that. Who am I to judge? We've heard the new Pope say already, not really judging, say who's going to throw the stone and then just admonishing her to go on her way and don't sin.
You know, this Pope is amazing. I was just reading he gave an amazing exhortation to the Catholic Church called Evangelii Gaudium, the joy of the Gospels. And he writes in there about, you know, he says that right in there, he talks to young people, he says, seeking happiness in material things is never a sure way of being happy in this world. It's a sure way of being unhappy. I mean, he talks about at the very end of this great exhortation, he says that, you know, he talks about the revolutionary nature of love and tenderness, which includes a generous vision toward other people. And he's, I think, trying to model that. It could be a whole new, I think it's in a sense the model of Francis and Jesus coming back into play again and working its old magic in the world, because this is the way we should behave toward other people.
Jay Parini's new book is Jesus, The Human Face of God. We'll talk about that subtitle as well. He joins us from Middlebury, Vermont. MC is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Hello, MC. Thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and thank you so much for this thoughtful program. I have a question, perhaps more of a comment. When, particularly at this time of year, the virgin birth, what I've always heard in terms of narrative was a marketing strategy for a religion. The marketing strategy, in my view, seems to have adopted what had been successful in other faiths, which was a primary god being, I'll say, Zeus, raping a virgin, and thus we have this godlike person among us. And I'm just curious, I'd be curious as to the author's thoughts on that, particularly because I feel it's interfered with the messages of Jesus as a thinker.
The Christmas story itself, the story of the nativity, the birth, the origin. MC, thanks. Jay Parini?
Well, you know, the story of the virgin birth is so fascinating, and the birth of Jesus in a manger. He is born, remember, a marginal person, not a famous person, not a rich person. He's really, you know, the son of a poor, poor, poor carpenter. And the passages about Jesus being born of a virgin, it goes back to Isaiah, the book of Isaiah 7, I think it's Isaiah 7:14, where the writer says that God will give you a child to this young maiden, and you shall bear a son and call him Emmanuel. Well, that's quoted then in the Christmas retelling of the Christmas stories.
Emmanuel, God is with us.
God is within us, right? Mm-hmm. God dwelling, the spark of God within you. And God, and Jesus will be born of a young maiden. The Hebrew mm-hmm. word is Alma. And then it gets somewhat mistranslated in the Greek rendering of that. There was a famous Greek translation of the Old Testament scripture called the Septuagint, and the word Alma gets translated as Parthenos, which can mean virgin, But as Geza Vermes points out, that in ancient times in Palestine, that word, even parthenos in Greek, didn't necessarily mean that the woman had not had sexual relations with her husband. So a lot has been made from this, obviously, and it's got beautiful mythic importance. And I do think it, in the time of Jesus, it was taken for granted that a great person could be born of, say, part God, part man. I mean, Jesus would have looked in his pocket and seen a coin with the emperor's face, Augustus, on the coin. And what did it say right beneath his face? Divi Filius, son of God. So son of God was, you know, a common phrase, and that an important person should be born. It was in fact said that the Caesar Augustus had been born in one of the great temples, partly from a god and partly from an earthly woman himself. And there are many stories about this going back a long way.
I mean, the Nativity is a beautiful story, but MC reads the story and sees or wonders about marketing. I mean, you talk about mythos. And she's, you know, just makes it more plain, in part, the salesmanship of a message, perhaps.
Well, it's also, when you think of the church trying to then theologize all of these, you know, what we've got in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are zillions of little bits and pieces of random data that we have to then synthesize into a real story or mythos. And the virgin birth and the story of Jesus' Christmas story is only one little piece of it. But at this time of year, it's important that the Christmas story should take place right around the time of the Roman Saturnalia, which was December 25th, and which is why we have Christmas then. It's the time of the year right around the winter solstice when the sunlight has shrunk to its smallest potential, and it's got deep symbolic meaning that Jesus, the light of the world, should come into the world at the point of extreme darkness. And so the Jesus story, Jesus comes to bring us hope at this very dark time of the year. Now, the entire church calendar is organized around the agricultural calendar. And so Easter and rebirth comes right when the spring is coming. So it's very elegantly positioned in the calendar.
If a framework of compelling convenience is put around this story to make it more compelling, does that hit your faith? You're a believer.
It doesn't bother me in the slightest. It only makes it all the more powerful. I love the fact that the church here is organized around the seasons. You know, I live in Vermont, where right now it's extremely cold. It's dark by 4 in the afternoon. Mm. And, you know, I dream about April and May, when the snow begins to melt and when the sun rises. And so, you know, I quote in one of my epigraphs to the chapter on the resurrection, all Christian thinking is resurrection thinking. And I talk about resurrection as not a resuscitation. I mean, in fact, I say when I talk about the actual resurrection of Jesus, I try to put it in not just mythic terms, but true terms. And I say this is not a story about the great resuscitation of Jesus. It's not that. It's about resurrection, which is a kind of transformation. You know, it's interesting to me that when you look at the Easter story, all the people who meet Jesus after he comes back to life again, Mary Magdalene in the cave doesn't recognize him. She wonders, who is this guy, the gardener? And he finally looks at her and says in his native Aramaic, Mary. And she says, Rabboni, meaning teacher. You know, when Jesus is walking on the road to Emmaus, he meets three disciples. And they're talking about what happened in Jerusalem. And haven't you heard about this? Jesus says, nah, tell me about it. And they tell him about the crucifixion of this great master, this great rabbi. Then he sits down and has dinner with them that night. And as they're breaking bread, he offers a prayer. Suddenly, they say, oh, my word, you're Jesus. And what happens? Poof, he disappears. When Jesus appears to some of the fishermen, Nathanael and Peter and others, the John, down on the Sea of Galilee, he's standing by the edge of the shore and they're fishing and they're desolate. They've gone back to their trade of fishing, having lost the Jesus and the Jesus movement. And he says, you're not catching anything. Throw your net on the other side of the boat. They do. All these fish come into their net. They come to shore. They don't know who this man is. Peter suddenly says, wait a minute. Are you Jesus? But, you know, it's emphasized in the Gospels over and over again, and especially in the 20 Gnostic Gospels, which were, you know, discovered in 1945, that Jesus, after his resurrection, does not simply get resuscitated, but is somehow transformed. And I think that the story of the cross is terribly central to Christianity because it's about, and St. Paul calls it, the word is kenosis, which means an emptying out of the self. And it's very Buddhist in a sense. You empty out the self to acquire a deeper self. T.S. Eliot, in his poem The Four Quartets, talks about finding the still point of the turning world, the timeless moment in time. And I read the crucifixion and the resurrection as a very central part of this great myth or mythos because it shows us how we can go through suffering and even death and still somehow find the eternal now, the kind of timeless moment in time.
When you share this view, this poetic view, this open-minded view with your priest, does he say, hey, Jay, you're heretical, or that's kind of loosey-goosey, or is he with you?
I have a very good priest here in Middlebury, Vermont. She's a biblical scholar with a PhD in ancient languages.
Okay.
She's
she. Yeah.
And we've talked about this. And in fact, I just conducted four sessions at my church, four Sundays in a row, where we went through my book and talked about the Jesus story. And I'm probably lucky to have a gathering that's very sympathetic to the kind of Jesus that I see. Jesus, remember, was talking about he wasn't founding a church, but he wanted to have gatherings. He says to Peter, "On you, Peter, I will found my church." But of course, the word he uses for church is ecclesia, which simply means a gathering. And Jesus there's so many angles to this story. The stories with Peter strike me as some of the most beautiful. Peter is always not quite getting it. Peter's always saying, oh, here's what you mean. And Jesus is going, Peter, that's wrong. At one point, Peter says something and Jesus says, get thee behind me, Satan. He uses that word scandalon in Greek, which means stumbling block. Mm. I just think it's a story that can be read on so many wonderful, witty levels. I mean, one of the things I do is go into some of the texture of the story. Looking, for instance, I love the story of Jesus versus Barabbas. Pontius Pilate comes out and he says on the porch of his palace, "Okay, crowd, once a year we give you a prisoner. Let's free this guy Jesus. I can't see that he's done anything wrong." And the crowd says, "Give us Barabbas! Give us Barabbas!" Well, Pilate says, "Are you sure?" Barabbas is a political revolutionary. And they say, yes, kill Jesus, give us Barabbas. Well, it couldn't have been lost on many of the Greek readers of that gospel, of these gospels, that the word Barabbas simply means in Aramaic, Bar Abbas. Jesus prays to his father God, Abba. Abbas, Bar Abbas means son of God. What was the first name of Barabbas? We learn from other parallel writings of the period that Barabbas' first name was Jesus. So what does this mean, this amazing story? Pilate comes out and says, would you like Jesus Barabbas, son of God, or would you like Jesus Christos, the son of God? It's incredibly complicated, this story. It's full of wit and delight.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the still unfolding story of Jesus with novelist, poet, biographer, believer, Jay Parini. His new book is Jesus, The Human Face of God. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Jay Parini joins us from Middlebury, Vermont. He's a professor at Middlebury there. Jay, lots of response. Paul says, writing here on Facebook, "I'm a mythicist. Jesus never existed." And Brandy says, "Whether he was real or not is irrelevant to me. He was a hippie and my kind of guy." Very, very casual there. Diane says, "I tell my kids he was a real man, was very good. A lot of other men have made up stories about him, turned him into a myth. Other men then use the myth to control masses of people for their own gain," Diane writes. "He sets a great example that most people who believe in him, the myth, don't follow," she writes. And then you've got straight-ahead believers as well. A full range. People kind of taking as they will here. Osmond's calling from Buffalo, New York. Osmond, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Well, hi, Tom.
Hello.
I wanted to talk about the Quranic perspective of Jesus' birth and mission. And the Quran tells us that he was born in a miraculous birth from one parent, the Virgin Mary. And he did all these other miracles of even giving life to the dead. And, of course, he spoke right from birth to defend his mom, who was being vilified by members of her community. So, of course, taught us kindness and love and worship of one God. But the truth is that he was chosen by God to be a prophet and a messenger. And he did not bring a new religion, but like all his predecessor prophets and messengers, he came to update the religion, because over the years, man always forgets how to worship God.
Osman, let me take it right there, if I may. Jay Perini, Osman's reading, he came not to bring a new religion, but to what, update an old one.
Well, I think that Osman has a really great point here. Christians often forget that Jesus, again and again, is saying, love God. You know, it's the old story of the man who's pointing to the moon, and the dog starts to bark at the man's finger, whereas the moon is the object of worship here, or of interest. I think Jesus was trying to put people into a new kind of relationship with God, or whatever we see as God, our ultimate concerns, our deepest sense of realities. One thing I'm trying in this book to do is to, which I try to do in my own life, is to walk this line between seeing Jesus as a real man, someone who actually walked in Galilee, who taught for a year, maybe 3 years, and was a real person, and the kind of cosmic Christ, this mythological figure. We're talking about levels of literal belief here, mm-hmm. and levels of symbolic understanding.
What is your literal belief? Is the historical evidence there? I mean, if you're writing as a scholar for that man walking in Galilee, saying words that are now written on a page?
Look, I don't think there is any doubt that there was a man called Jesus who walked in Galilee and performed these acts, many of these wonderful things that are told about in the Gospels. St. Paul was writing about Jesus only 20 years after, but the main Gospels were written 40, 50 years after Jesus. And it's like us trying to remember, say, John Kennedy. Can we remember that John Kennedy was on this earth? It's not that far in the past. Mm-hmm. And I think oral history carried these great stories. You should hear about what happened, this guy Jesus. Here's what he said. There was a tremendous memory in those days for things like sayings. I mean, in ancient Greece, people could recite the entire Iliad, the entire Odyssey. So I think we know there was a man called Jesus. He's mentioned by Flavius Josephus, who is a reliable Jewish Roman historian. He's mentioned briefly by Tacitus, by Suetonius. And the Gospels themselves are, you know, I think true. There's a wonderful book by a Scottish theologian, or is a British theologian at the University of St. Andrews, Richard Baucom, called the Gospels as eyewitness testimony. And he really, you know, traces the possibilities that what we get in the Gospels is an actual retelling of something that might have happened.
So, but you're saying it to us today that elements of those Gospels were written many years later, the Christmas story you cited in particular.
Absolutely. I think that these texts, I mean, obviously, we're talking about a religion that's based on texts. I mean, anything we know about Jesus practically will come from either the four canonical Gospels or the 20-something Gnostic Gospels, most of which weren't discovered until 1945 out in the deserts of Egypt. So we have to base our belief in Jesus, and by belief, I mean what we hold dearly in his story and how his life is something we can imitate to our benefit and to the benefit of people generally speaking, because, you know, in loving our neighbors as ourselves, I think we take a different attitude toward the material world, toward materialism. I think we see, you know, I think we would behave very differently about wars if we took the message of Jesus seriously. You know, I think it's not for nothing that Martin Luther King, Tolstoy, Gandhi really understood the Sermon on the Mount as telling us a way of non-resistance to evil, how to deal with the evil in the world. It's a very challenging teaching. You know, to take this stuff seriously is, to me, what's important. Again and again, I say, let's go back to the Sermon on the Mount. Let's see, who are the blessed? Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are the merciful, for God shall be merciful to them. You know, blessed are the meek. Very interesting message.
Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Whatever that means. Some of our listeners respond to that, and others, not so much. Stevie writes, about Jesus as a symbol of purity, God's love for us. If we live our lives by his words, we will show others the purity God's given each of us. We will have life everlasting. There's the believer view that Dana says, as a former evangelical Christian, I now see Jesus as a wise man, maybe even a spiritually gifted one, but not as a deity. Does it matter to you? I can't tell from the way you write.
It doesn't matter to me. I think that it's all about language here. I say that when I use the word God, what do I mean? I think I refer to – people say to me, oh, do you believe in God? I mean, how can you do that? I can remember I once did a debate with Christopher Hitchens in Philadelphia about 3 years ago, and we talked about this. I mean, I said to him on stage, I think that atheists and fundamentalist Christians are both, in a sense, being far too literal about this stuff. And I think that they're missing the deeper truth. And I think to be literal about God is to miss the larger truth about God. You somehow miss the heft, the real interest of the story. Not interest, but I think it's an experience. I think you have to say that God is an experience. And, I try in my daily meditations to read the Bible and to pray and to get as close as I can to some central being. And I think that in grounding my life in these moments of silence and trying to listen to this, you mentioned earlier that this is an unfolding story, and I think that's the essence of Christianity, that word unfolding. It's a continual revelation. And the revelation, as you see in my book, is not simply the revelation of the four Gospels or the letters of Paul, but the revelation is an ongoing. I love the line in St. Paul where he says that that the Spirit is ongoing and that revelation is ongoing.
Is every religion then a continuing revelation, or is there something unique here? How do you set up a continuing revelation in a few years on Earth?
It's funny. I was just listening last week to some recent YouTube interviews with Billy Graham, where even Billy Graham says, you know, there are many paths to God or to salvation or to enlightenment. And I certainly believe without any question that there are many, many paths toward reconciliation with creation, with coming to terms with the Creator.
But is it the ambiguity of the teaching of Jesus, at least as written down in the religious text, that leads to this continual revelation? I mean, part of what you describe here, and you quote T.S. Eliot as well, is about the ambiguity, the lack of clarity sometimes. T.S. Eliot writes in The Dry Savages, there are only hints and guesses, hints followed by guesses. And you're sort of picking that up here, saying there's not all clarity here.
Well, I think recently I was asked to fill out a form, and they said religion. I put down the four quartets of T.S. Eliot. I think he synthesizes all world religion, in a sense, in that wonderful sequence of poems. And he talks about illumination being simply hints and guesses. And I think that there are moments when, like, we see in a shaft of sunlight a moment of eternity. Wordsworth called this spots of time. I think, there are moments of epiphany when this something is revealed to us. And for most of us, it's really just distraction. We can't get at any truth. We just move along in a very narrow band of consciousness. But I think one of the things that the practice of religion affords people is an opportunity to go deeper, to enter into layers of consciousness where we see the sunlight for a brief moment. We catch a glimpse of eternity. And Eliot says there, but for the most of the time, it's simply prayer, meditation, discipline, thought, and crucially, action. And Tolstoy stressed that. That's what I love about Tolstoy's writing. He says Christianity is a religion mainly of action. You go out on the ground, you find the homeless and you feed them, you give money to the poor, you help the poor, you talk to your neighbor who's disaffected, you talk to the gay man, the gay woman, you talk to the prostitute, you talk. Jesus would go anywhere, talk to anybody one-on-one. And I think the Gospels are nothing but stories of his amazing encounters with people mostly on the margins of society and making a direct contact with them and saying, you can be healed. You are part of us. We can make you whole.
What do you mean when you say the human face of God? What do you mean when you say that?
it's impossible to see God. It says in the Old Testament, seek his face, but we can't see the face of God. So St. Augustine talks about Jesus as being somehow a way in which the concrete example of God was put before us in a living fashion. And so Jesus, to me, represents, I call Jesus the human face of God, because in Jesus we see him, God. I think it's a way through. Now, there might be many other ways to see God. I mean, I think we could seek God through all kinds of different formal religious practices. And I would close out nothing here. But I certainly believe that Jesus is a very primary for the whole West. The last 20 centuries, billions of people have looked at this life and seen, here's something I can imitate. Here's something I can understand. Here's a language that makes sense to me and is going to allow me somehow to live my life in a better way and to create community in a real way. And it's all about the creation of community.
Is there something here for the atheist who says this language, this idea of God doesn't come to me? And Jesus may have had lovely teachings, but they also open a kind of path to suspension of reason that you know, atheists may find unsettling or even skewing to our view of the world.
Well, I think if you read the life of Jesus, say, if you're an atheist, I think you can still read the life of Jesus and see it as one of the greatest poems of all time, and one that has great religious great truth to it. You can watch a play of Shakespeare and see that there is deep truth there that can actually be life-transforming. And I'm hoping even an atheist can read my book and will read my book and see that the life of Jesus offers ways into deeper levels of consciousness. I mean, there's no reason why an atheist can't find very deep levels of consciousness and find ethical ways of being in the world. I think they largely do. The ethical teachings of Jesus are kind of eternal, and they go back even before Jesus. I mean, the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, is there in Confucianism, it's there in Hinduism, it's there in Buddhism. It's a very ancient teaching. I mean, we can find it in ancient Sumeria. So Jesus is, to some degree, as I said earlier, reformulating some of the great truths, putting them into a pattern in the Sermon on the Mount where they're accessible. And I think even an atheist can read Matthew 5, 6, and 7 and be blown away by it. The teachings there are so transformative.
Alice in Auburn, Alabama. Alice, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Tom. I'm fascinated by this discussion. I'm so happy you're having it. I, too, am a believer. And you asked earlier what was the drawing point of Jesus, and I think it was simply loving others, serving others. And I just think that his example of caring for the, as Jay said, on the margins of society, is an example for us to follow. I'm trying to do that this Christmas by helping some people who otherwise wouldn't have a good Christmas, but his example of love and the hope he gives for a brighter future, for an afterlife, I think there had to be something about the person of Jesus to draw those fishermen to just lay down their nets and come follow him.
Alice, I appreciate your call. Thank you. Thank you. Our time grows short here. Jay,
do you take it to the
afterlife? Yes, I will, of course.
Well, yes, but I think I'm much more interested in this life. I think the phrase eternity is now is where I am. And I'm not so much interested in the afterlife. In fact, one of Jesus' friends, disciples, said, hey, what's it going to be like in the afterlife? And Jesus, the only mention he has in the whole Gospels of this is, oh, we'll be something like the angels. So he was more concerned about this life. And so I'm seeing Christianity as not a set of boxes that we have to tick off. I believe X, Y, and Z, therefore I am saved. I think that's simply a misrepresentation of Christianity. I'm saying understand that, you know, God so loved the world that he sent his son into the world so that the world through him could experience reconciliation, peace. I mean, I see Jesus as the genuine Prince of Peace. And I'm all for belief, but only in the sense of credo, which comes from the original roots, cordu. I give my heart to something. I hold it very dearly. And so my Jesus in this book is not the Jesus of do this and don't do that, but it's a Jesus of of hold this dearly, and it's the Greek word faith is really is pistis, and it really means trust, and it's about ultimate trust in being held up in the hand and being buoyed up and carried along.
An unfolding story 2,000 years on, so many strands. We have listeners who will follow them and listeners who do not, listeners who will see it as the most important religious story in their lives, listeners who will hear it as something quite apart from divinity. However you look at it, it's a fascinating story, all kinds of impact across centuries. Jay Perini, you tell it well. The book is Jesus, the Human Face of God. Jay, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Tom. It was really fun to be on your show.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.